second part of the parable of the ten virgins, carrying on from where we left off this evening, just a few minutes ago. Now I want next of all to just discuss with you for a few moments why it is that God has chosen to work in the particular fashion that we see here outlined for us on this diagram. Because here we have God's battle plan for the finishing of the work. Let's go back for a moment to the beginning. God did not send the message through William Miller until the church had reached a very, very low ebb of apostasy. And the first question I want to ask is this: why did God wait so long before he chose to send this message through William Miller? Very good reason for this. And the reason lies in the fact that God is a very great respecter of that which he himself has instituted in this world. Pardon me. And God, of course, has appointed the ministry in the churches as his agents through whom the message would come to the people in the churches. It says there in Corinthians, he's given some apostles, some prophets, some teachers, and so on. Now, God does not bypass his own divinely appointed agencies for spreading the truth. But as time went by and God sought again and again to reach the people through the ministry kept resisting and resisting God's appeal until things came to that place where they made it plain that they had rejected their commission. When that time came, God no longer had any responsibility to work for them at all. And so it was that God went out and chose a humble messenger in the person of William Miller. And through that man, he sent the message of light into the fallen churches. Now mark this point with care. Go back to any point of history, be it John the Baptist's day, be it Elijah's day, be it Luther's day or Miller's day or any other point of history, and when you find that God sends a messenger outside of the appointed ministry, then just so surely can you know the time has come when God has rejected the ministry. That's clear, isn't it? Clear as can be. Not because he does this arbitrarily, but because they, by their apostasy, bring themselves to the place where God can use them no longer. But the point, as far as we're concerned, is this: that we're not able to judge when things have come to the place where God has, when the ministry have been rejected of God, excepting by this evidence, that when you find that God sends along a messenger who never did have a partner or place in the ministry, the regular ministry, and that man carries the present truth for this hour, which is proved by the testing of that present truth, then just so surely can we know that God has come to the place where he can no longer work for the ministry at all. That should be clear. That's how it was in John the Baptist's day. That's how it was back in William Miller's day, and that's how it is again today in our own time. Now, very obviously, of course, Miller came out of great darkness himself and couldn't understand all the truth and all the light for his time. And so it was that he could not reach every single person in the church who was honest and faithful. But the message was of sufficient strength to reach those folk in the church who did have something of a personal living experience with God. That is, that class of folk who were sharp in their spiritual perceptions, who are not afraid of the ministry and its organizations, who are not bound to organization, but who love the truth above all else and were prepared to follow the truth no matter what the cost may be. They were, in other words, the kind of folk who make leaders in the church of God. Now, so in God's providence, of course, this group were taken out into complete separation. Now, they were placed out there because God desired to use them to reach those who had not been reached by the first proclamation of the message. To do that, they'd have to have more light and more power than did the first messenger, William Miller, in order to reach those who could not be reached by the message in the beginning. Therefore, they had to go through a period of schooling or preparation. And that, I think, should be very significant and meaningful to our minds in the light of our own experiences over the past few years. Now, mark this point with care, whenever, and there's no exceptions to this, whenever God desires to school a man or a group of people for the giving of a future message, then God always separates that group from the present organized churches. Think about it. Think of Moses. What did God do with him? Separated him. Think of John the Baptist. What did God do with him? Separated him. Think of Elijah. What did God do with him? Separated him. Think of Luther. What did God do with him? Sent him away by himself in a cloister where he could study for himself apart from the influence of the church, and thus he was prepared for the work that he was to do. And always, God has taken his people out of the influence of the churches in which they stand and separated them so he could train them and prepare them to give a message to those who needed it. Now then, of course, when a message goes, it always brings out wise and foolish virgins. It never misses. Because when God sows the good seed, what does the enemy come behind and do? He sows the tares in the same field. And the tares, of course, spring up with the wheat, and they have to be harvested and separated in time. Now, just as God could not work through 32,000 soldiers under Gideon's command, or even with 10,000 soldiers under Gideon's command, when amongst them there were only 300 who were true and faithful, so God had to send a shaking back here to divide the wise from the foolish, to give him a body of people who were essentially wise virgins, who had the living experience, who could receive the second angel's message, and who could receive the midnight cry and give that message. And so here we find God preparing a people to give a message. See the point? The same as God prepared John the Baptist, the same as God prepared Christ and Moses and Elijah and the other men of his calling back in the past. Now in the meantime, something else is happening, because these hidden ones who were so loyal to the church they could not even bear to think of separation in any sense of the word at all, found that with the departure of the wise and the foolish, the churches fell into a very, very cold condition. And sins which had been secret and hidden back here now became open and flagrant in the church. The pulpit now only had chaff to give, where at least before there was some body in the message. Troubles began to increase in the church. The coldness became more marked, and so these hidden ones became more and more restive, discontented and uncertain and bewildered, and became more and more hungry for real and living food. So what's happening? They are being prepared to receive what these are being prepared to give. Now, could you think of a better plan, better strategy? Certainly not. And when that point of time came when these were prepared to give and these to receive, then what did God do? He poured out the mighty power of the Holy Spirit in the midnight cry. The message went with power, and think of it, in 2.5 months, won 50,000 people to the message. 2.5 months. From August the 14th, 1844, to October the 22nd, 1844. Now true, they were not all wise virgins, unfortunately, but it was a tremendous ingathering of souls nonetheless. And they could have been saved, they could have gone on to victory and glory, if they'd only chosen to patiently hang on to the truth which God had given to them. Now, there is, of course, God's battle plan. You'll hear people arguing, well, we should stay in the church. If we don't stay amongst the people down here, how can we reach them? That's human reasoning, isn't it? Here is God's reasoning. God says, come out and become sharpened instruments, and then go back and do your work amongst the fallen churches. When today people come to me and say, well, now look, we have pages and pages in the Spirit of Prophecy about being an evangelistic body, about going out and winning souls for Christ and so forth. True, that is true of a church in a different period of time to what we're talking about today. We today are not the Adventist Church of the 1880s or 1890s or 1900 or 1860 or 70 or any of those times. We today are in the same position as they were in the tarrying time of the parable back there. And therefore our task today is not so much evangelism as it is preparation. That's our task at the present moment. Now, having studied then the first fulfillment of the parable of Matthew 25, And having learned in clear and conclusive terms that this is a fulfillment to the very letter, the has been of the past, and we're to see this thing repeated in the future, the time has then come to decide from the evidences of God's word as to whether that fulfillment is yet future or whether today we are already in the unrolling of this scroll for the second time. Now the evidences are not difficult to find. Although I have found that some folk do experience some difficulty in following out the logic of this next argument. Let's see if we can understand it this evening in the following light. Now the principle, I'm going back to Matthew 22 now for a moment, because as I said before, we have to be able to lay all these prophecies down side by side and have each one harmoniously fitting into the prophecy before it. The same as you can take Daniel 2 and lay it out, then take Daniel 7 and lay it out parallel to it, and you find the two fit together in perfect harmony, correct? They're not two disjointed prophecies, they are harmonious interlocking prophecies. And so Matthew 22, the 2 days of opportunity in Matthew 25, all must fit together in the same kind of perfect harmony. And just a brief rehearsal again, Matthew 22 is the prophecy where the marriage was made. The first call goes to what class of people?
Bidden ones.
They refuse it. The second call goes to what class? Bidden ones. And then the word says, no more calls to the bidden ones. Right? Now, do you realize that this thing is repeated in principle elsewhere in the Word of God? Let's go back, shall we, to the parable of the Good Samaritan and see it there. Beside the road on the way to Jericho lay an injured man. And an injured man was a symbol of a needy world, a fallen world. Isn't that what that man symbolized? Good. Now, what nation had God called to be the uplifters of fallen humanity? Israel. Good. And who should have been the leaders in that work of lifting up fallen humanity? The priests. And so whom did God bring by, first of all, to look at that man upon the roadside? A priest. There he came. And that was opportunity number one. And the priest, of course, went by on the far side of the road and didn't even look at the fallen man. Right? What did God bring next of all? A Levite of what nation? Israelites. Now, who was the higher, the priest or the Levite? The priest was, and he should have been the first to do it, so when he wouldn't do it, God went to a lesser strata of, or lesser level of responsibility, and gave the opportunity there. And what did that man do? He refused it too. He came and looked at the man, and then passed on along his way, fearful no doubt that he might be overtaken by the robbers too. Very good. Now, what was the next man of Israel that God brought along? He didn't bring an Israelite, did he, anymore? He didn't. The call went now outside of the household of Israel to a despised Samaritan, and that man did what Israel might have done. When Israel had two opportunities, then the third one went to another class of people, even to a Samaritan. No, they were a different originally, but spiritually they were a different race altogether, different religion, everything. And they were despised by the Jews as a foreign race of people. Now, I want now to show how this same thing is true so far as the Protestant churches are concerned in the Middle Ages. A bit short of blackboard space here, but I'll see what we can do. Now, I want you to follow this very closely at this point because this is important. Let's try over here perhaps. Let's take now the Protestant Reformation, and in the years 1300, 1400 and 1500, in those 200 years, the Protestant Reformation was born. Now in 1300 we find that John Wycliffe began his work in England. In 1400 Huss and Jerome worked in Bohemia, which is now Czechoslovakia, and in 1500, of course, we have Martin Luther in Germany. And as a result of the efforts of 200 years, the Protestant Reformation was born, and they became the bidden ones in the sense that they were God's people through whom the message should be given to a perishing world. That was the Church of God at that time. Now, sad to say, with the death of the leaders, apostasy set in. And so God sent to them a mighty revival voice in the person of the Wesleys in what we know as the 18th century. which of course was the period from 1700 to 1800. Now what century followed the 18th century? The 19th century, which was 1844 and all that. Now when God sent the Wesleys with the mighty preaching of the everlasting gospel to the Protestant churches, what did the Protestant churches do with the Wesleys? And the Moravians, of course, and Zinzendorf and so forth on the continent. What did they do with them? They persecuted them and rejected their message. We call that. Now, that was the first call directed to the Protestant churches. You don't find Wesley going out and preaching to the heathen in China, in Africa, and Japan. Although he did make an attempt with the Indians before he was converted, unsuccessfully. But once he got the message and became God's chosen instrument, to whom did he go? The lost sheep of the house of Israel, didn't he? That's where he went. And they turned him down. And that was the first call to the Protestant churches. Now let me emphasize here, I am not saying that the history of the Protestant churches was an exact direct fulfillment of Matthew 22. What I am saying is that the same principle involved in Matthew 22 is involved here again. Now the second call came to the Protestant churches from 1833 to 1844. Right? That was the second call. And what did the Protestant churches do this time? With greater emphasis, didn't they, and greater rejection than the previous call. When they turned down their second call, what did they become? Fallen Babylon. They ceased to be the Church of God in any sense of the word at all. Is that clear? And has the Protestant churches ever received a third call as churches? Will they ever? Never. Two calls and two alone can ever go to the people of God, and when they turn the second call down, they're finished as a church and as an organization. Now what is important now for you to see is this. In 1833 began the second call so far as the Protestant churches were concerned. What began the same year? The beginning of this parable, Matthew 25. In other words, just as I showed you before, if I can just sketch up here briefly the previous study we've been through, here we have the 70 years of, I'm going back now to the 2 days of opportunity, there's the 70 years of Babylonian captivity, here begins the 490 years at this point here, and the final rejection of the Jews, which corresponds of course to the 1260 years here, then from 1844 down to whenever probation is going to end at that point, with the 2300 days connecting that point with that point there, as we mentioned previously. Now remember how we showed how Matthew 22 does not begin where that prophecy begins there. Matthew 22 begins at this point and explains that part of the prophecy in greater detail. That's clear, isn't it? Now in like manner, Matthew 25 does not go right back to the beginning of Matthew 22, but it illuminates a certain last portion of Matthew 22. And what is the last portion? The second call portion. So all you have to do is to ask yourself this question, at what point of time does the second call begin? And that once you have the answer as to when Matthew 25 begins. Is that clear? Now, if it isn't clear, say so, because I have found that people do have difficulty in seeing this. Just hold on. But I do find that folk have a little difficulty in just understanding this. Now the point I'm trying to make is this, that each successive prophecy does not go right back to the beginning of the previous one, but each successive prophecy in greater detail illuminates the last portion of the previous prophecy. In other words, Matthew 22 takes up only the actual second day of opportunity there, while Matthew 25 takes up the last portion of Matthew 22, which is the second call. In other words, coming back to the Protestant churches again, they were established in the 1300s to 1500 period. The first call came in the 18th century and the second call came in the 19th century. The second call came from 1833 to 1844. Good. So there we have the second call. Now, does not Matthew 25 as a complete parable cover the period only of the second call? That is to say, the beginning of the second call of Matthew 22 is also the beginning of the parable of Matthew 25. That's clear, isn't it? Good. Belches. Now then, let's carry on. Now then, that being so, having established that fact, then all we have to do from that point of time on is ask this question only: at what point of time does the second call begin? And then you know at once at what point of time the parable of Matthew 25 begins. Isn't that right? Is that clear now? Good. Good. Now let me ask you this question then. At what point of time did the second call to the Seventh-day Adventist Church begin? What was the date? The second call to the Adventist Church. Well, let's go over the parable again. When was the marriage made for the Adventist Church? Right. When was the first call? When was the second call? 1950. So when then does the second fulfillment of Matthew 25 begin? 1950. That's clear, isn't it? 1950. Now, I want to emphasize right here that back in 1950, and even in 1958, and even in 1962, we never had the least understanding of the truth of this prophecy. It was all something to be unfolded in the future, and we found ourselves covering a great deal of the ground involved in this prophecy before we began to understand that we had covered a pathway already foretold in prophecy. And that unfolding came at a time, exactly the time outlined here when the second angel's message was revealed. But let's go back, shall we, to 1950 and look at the condition of the Seventh-day Adventist Church back at that time. All right, let's write down 1950 now here, and we're now dealing with the second call to the marriage. I mean, the second application of Matthew 25. Now, what was the condition of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, because that was the church of God at that time, back in 1950? Was it a church bound together by cords? Was it a church in which there were but few people here and there that looked upward toward heaven, while the majority had their minds devoted to earthly things? That was the picture, right? Now, to that church, God sent the glorious light of the first angel's message, which is the everlasting gospel. Now, in one of the next studies, we take up the shaking from early writings. We'll show how the 1888 message is the Laodicean message. And of course, Sister White describes the 1888 message as being the third angel's message in verity. Isn't that right? Now, that message came to the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, true, it was opposed, it was fought against, and it never had the breadth of proclamation which it ought to have had. It was held up before the churches in sufficient power, as it says here in Great Controversy, page 373, and this, of course, was repeated again at that time. It was held up before the churches in sufficient power for there to be a general rejection on the part of the churches. Isn't that right? There was a general rejection on the part of the churches, and angels, of course, turned away in sadness. Now, running down through time, of course, we come down to about 1958, after that message had been held up before the church for quite a few years, and then the ugly head of persecution began to be really felt by the believers in the message. And there are people in this room who can remember back to those days, and you know what hostility was generated by the church against anybody who dared to think differently from the church's idea of things. Remember those days? I'll never forget them. And what happened? Out of that church went a company into separation, and the Brinsmeads were included in that group. Now, I know today that the Brinsmeads deny they ever had any separation leanings, but that denial is strictly dishonest, because I was personally acquainted with the Brinsmeads in New Zealand and Australia, and I will never forget how back in those days they actively and openly campaigned for all the believers to withdraw their tithe support from the church and give it to those who were the Brinsmead appointed ministers. And I remember how that the Brinsmead said openly the Seventh-day Adventist Church did not preach the third angel's message. They were not the church of God, and we should not in any sense of the word support that church at all, but regard ourselves as being open opponents of her programs and of her teachings. That was a stand she took back at that time. But the Brinsmeads, and I'll mention them because they definitely figure in this prophecy, were a group of people who never had a personal experience in the power of the everlasting gospel. And I say that because I've heard them say, well, our only hope is the final atonement. Until that time comes, we're still going to have the old carnal nature. Now, if you believe that until some future date you're going to retain the carnal nature, then what have you got at the present moment? You've got the carnal nature. Because your experience will never reach higher than your faith. Isn't that true? And if I believe I've got it, then you can be sure I have got it. But if I know by living faith God has taken it and given me a new life in this place, then where's the carnal nature? It's gone. And I'll never forget how back in 1962, when I first went to Australia from New Zealand, how my greatest concern was to carry to the Brinsmead believers in Australia the living message of Romans 7 and 8, so they could cease looking to pie in the sky by and by and learn and gain a personal, present experience in the power of the gospel. And I'll never forget that first meeting I conducted in the Brinsmead camp back in 1962 at Benora Point, in the home of Bob and John's father and mother, and there were about 70 Brinsmead followers present, that as I just presented the simple truth and power of Romans 7 and 8, they just rose up against me and declared I was tearing their whole message apart completely. That was a declaration. And I said in astonishment to them, I said, well, I said, I thought you folk believed in Wagner and Jones. And I said, how come that Bob Brinsmead on page 126 of his book, God's Eternal Purpose, says that the carnal nature cannot be carried along in the Christian experience. It has to be left dead and buried behind at the beginning. And of course, cool things down somewhat, as you can appreciate. Well, as a great deal of history took place in the ensuing months, but as I mentioned this morning, we became very much concerned as we saw the General Conference heading up toward their 1962 session. And we knew this was the very last Court of Appeal. And we prayed most earnestly that they would accept the message. And at that time, as those of you can remember back, the awakening message, as it was called, was a unified matter. And all these different voices, which are now independent around America in particular, around Germany and around Australia, were not then scattered and running independent courses as they are at the present time. But there was a unified awakening back in those days, we call it. And I was anxious to see it kept that way. And then in 1962, out of an absolutely clear blue sky, unexpected, unpremeditated, there suddenly happened an inexplicable, dramatic, and complete reversal of the policy of the majority of the awakening, of the awakeners. And they literally fled back to the church again. Remember it? At that time? They fled back to the church. And left a tiny handful of believers in North New South Wales and New Zealand who said, how can we go back? We know God came to us with a living message. It's transformed our lives. It's bound our families together. It's exposed the wrongs in the church. And if we came out of the church in 1958 to 1962 on these grounds, if those grounds have not changed, then how can we go back? Was that a principle stand? Well, certainly it was. Was that a stand which followed the noble footsteps of our Advent forefathers? Well, certainly it was. And so we stood. And I tell you this, that of all the darkest days of my life, the last months of 1962 and the first months of 1963 were days of darkness and discouragement. As it says here in the book Early Writings, I can't read these words without remembering the experience we went through back at that time, because this is exactly what we did go through. And I just wish that all of us could have gone to these experiences, because they'd be just that much more meaningful to you as they are to those of us who went through them. It says, as discouragement settled upon the waiting ones, the ministers and leading men whom I had before noticed rejoiced. And all those who had rejected the light triumphed greatly, while Satan and his evil angels also exulted. Now, I'll never forget that shortly after the division took place in Australia and New Zealand, I was down in the city of Auckland in New Zealand, and Pastor Hankinson, the youth leader, I think he was at that time, in that particular conference, came into the room and caught me there, I'll use the word caught me there, in the home of an Adventist family. the Clarks by name, an English-Scots family. She was a Spanish lady, actually, and he was an English-Scotch mixture, I believe, or mainly Scotch. And when Hangerson caught me there, he really triumphed and exulted. And he turned upon me and he said, rather sarcastically, he said, "I heard that you and Brinsmead have split." Well, he said, "We expected it. We knew it was coming." And he said, "What are you going to do now?" He said, "Brinsmead's coming back to the church and all his followers. What about you?" And he just went to work on me there and told how they knew this was going to come. It was inevitable. We were all the movements in the past. And I sat there, and what could I say? I had no answers for him. I had nothing I could say back. His was a day of triumph, and all I could do was sit there and take all the insult and abuse that man could heap upon my head, until finally he left, and I was glad. You see, at that time, all we could do was sit and wait till clearer light should be given. We knew God led us that far. We knew we could not go back without the denying the experience which God had given to us. And so we hung on. And several months went by, during which time the Lord, by trials and tribulations, sifted out those who had hung on a little bit after the main body had gone back into the church again, until only those who did have a personal experience remained in the group down there in Australia and New Zealand. And believe me, a bare 6 years ago, that group numbered scarcely any more people than those who are in this room tonight. Think of it. In the entire world field, just as few people as this hung on to the living message of Christ and His righteousness and refused to be taken in by the general apostasy. And look how marvelously in the last 6 years this thing has grown to be a worldwide movement. Now, as we said before, now, I might mention, up till this point, we knew nothing about the 2 days of opportunity. We knew nothing about Matthew 22. We knew nothing about this study on Matthew 25. We have simply followed as God has led us, the same as it did back in 1844. But now, God in His great goodness gave to us the second angel's message. And they began to unfold to our minds down there in Australia these prophecies which I'm studying with you over these 2 or 3 days this weekend, when our theme is, as I've said at the beginning, by special request, that we take up all the evidences that prove that we are the prophetically predicted Church of God at the present time. Now, you can imagine, or can you imagine, the joy and the confidence and the wonder that came over us as these prophecies opened up, and to our astonishment we saw that we had exactly, though unwittingly, followed exactly as God said we would up till this point of time. No wonder we have a more sure word of prophecy, a light in a dark place, a comfort and a guide and a blessing to God's people. But here's the point. Around the world today, the only people who understand these prophecies and accept them are those who receive the gospel in its power in the first angel's message. Do you realize that? Nobody else does. Just nobody. The Brinsmead don't understand them. The church doesn't understand them. The other different little groups around the world field don't understand them. And they can't understand them because the prophecy says the light shone upon whom? Those desponding ones. Not those who went back to the church again. Not those who scattered off in their own directions, but upon this company of people that light shone. That is, upon those who had received the light of the first angel in its power and in its efficiency to take away sin from the soul of each one of us. Now, as you folk are witness, and you know this by your own experience, that from that day to this, what has been happening? We've been receiving what? Light. And more light, and still more light, and still more light. And every camp meeting we come to, what do we find? More light yet. Isn't that right? More light yet. And you're conscious of the fact, in the plainest of terms, that God has been carrying on in your heart and in my heart a very thorough, a very solid and comprehensive work of preparation. Isn't that true? And we're comforted by the fact that today God has not chosen to use us extensively in missionary endeavor. He hasn't sent us out proclaiming the message in the power of the Spirit yet. That's coming. In the meantime, like Moses out there in the plains of Moab, like John the Baptist in the wilderness, like Elijah back in the hill country of Gilead, and so forth, we are tucked away in separation, in obscurity, unknown by the world, unrecognized, unheard of. But God knows where we are, and we're in school. Isn't that right? We're in school. And God is preparing us to receive a mighty outpouring of the Spirit, which this time will be the midnight cry. It'll be the loud cry, the final work of the proclamation of the fourth angel's message. Now, I want to go back a moment now to the statement again on page 373 in the book Great Controversy, where Sister White says here, angels were watching with the deepest interest the result of the warning. And you can be quite sure that back there in the 1950 period, when the 1888 message was being held up before the people of God and the Adventist Church, that angels were watching with intense interest to see how the Advent folk would take that message. Now let's face the fact, while the devil made the issues to be as clouded and as obscure as he could, the fact remains that there was a general rejection of the message by the churches. What about the General Conference Committee? Yes. The North American Division? Yes. The sundry unions around this field, and Australia too? Yes. Individual churches, right across America and Australia and Europe in particular, there was a general rejection of the message by the churches. And even though they might not have known what they were doing, the fact remains they did it. And that's what counts in God's sight. Isn't that true? Absolutely. But let's face this fact, there are many, and I'll use this now in the present tense, or there were many who had not yet been tested in regard to the Advent truth. Many were misled by husbands, wives, parents, or children, and were made to believe it a sin even to listen to such heresies as were taught by the Adventists. Now there are people in this room who are not involved with us in this original battle with the church, right? There are some of you who never even heard the message till after 1962, some in this room. You were not tested by the message back there when we were. But mark these words, angels were bidden to keep faithful watch over these souls, over you folk, for another light was yet to shine upon them from the throne of God. Now we're going to find in our next study from the shaking, it might not be the next one quite, but in a study which is coming up on the shaking, that during this period here, there are individuals who come out in advance of the general coming out during the loud cry period and take the places of those who are shaken out and left by the way. I'll read you that later in the future study. And those of you who are not part of the original shaking back here but came in later fulfill that part of the prediction, and you can look back now and see how God was preparing you because you became concerned. You began to get hungry in your souls for something better. Isn't that true? You began to become conscious of the chaff that you were being served up from the pulpits. And as you hungered for something better, and as you got ready for the something better, then what did God do? He brought those of us who were prepared to give from the desert to those of you who were prepared to receive. And what happened? You came out and joined with the true people of God up in this position here. But there are many yet in the Seventh-day Adventist churches, and not only there but in the outside churches as well, who are God's true children, but who are not yet ready to receive this message. And that's why it is that I don't go plunging into the church, scattering literature hither and yonder and urging folk to come out of it, but rather I go sensitively along listening to the voice of God, and as he opens up an interest here, and somebody else becomes ready over here, then we give to them the bread of life. They gladly accept it and come out. But the rest, they're safe in the care of the angels who can look after them better than I can and who will not be left by God, but who, when the time comes, will gladly come out and take their place with God's commandment-keeping people. And so today, we find ourselves living in an extremely significant point of time in history. We are living today in the very shadow of the loud cry. We are living here in 1970. That's the point of time to which we've come. We can look back and we can see that all this is now a thing of the past up until that point. We can look and see the midnight cry or the loud cry is yet future. It hasn't begun yet. But, prophetically speaking, in every prophecy which we have before us today, there's nothing between us now and the loud cry yet to happen, excepting for our final preparation and the final preparation of the people of God in the churches to receive this light. That's all that's left to happen. Now, how soon this is going to be, of course, we don't know. Because midnight is the most unexpected hour for the proclamation of the message for the bridegroom to come. The word says, and at midnight the cry was made, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go you out to meet him. Very good. So here we are, sound asleep at midnight, expecting to have 4 or 5 more hours of sleep before the morning. When suddenly a cry rings out, behold, the bridegroom cometh, go you out to meet him. What happens? The virgins leap up from their sleep, hastily grab their lamps, trim them, and go out to meet the bridegroom. And then it is found during that period who have the sacred oil in their lamps and who does not have the sacred oil in our lamps. Now I must stress at this moment and at this point that when that midnight cry begins, it'll be too late to get the oil in your lamps. Too late. As Sister White says in Testimonies to Ministers, the latter rain, if the early rain has not done its work, the latter rain can do what? Bring no seed to perfection. True? So tonight, we either have the oil in our lamps or we don't have the oil in our lamps. The lamp, of course, the oil in the lamp symbolizes the living presence of the Holy Spirit in our lives as an occupant. And he can never be there as an occupant unless, first of all, the other occupant has been taken out. Namely, of course, the old carnal nature. The spirit of Satan that must be gone, the old tree, the carnal nature, the old sin master, the law of sin in my members, that all must be gone and replaced by a new power and a new life, even the Holy Spirit, and then we have the sacred oil in our lamps. And if we have that sacred oil, then when that time comes, we shall be filled with the Spirit and go forth to give that mighty and powerful message to a perishing world. Then it'll be this from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, from the Roman Catholic Church, from the Protestant churches, from every church in the world, the hidden ones will be revealed to view and come out and take their stand as God's commandment-keeping people. Now I want now to turn your attention to Revelation chapter 18 for a moment, to read the message of this and see how it exactly teaches the same thing as this parable of Matthew 25. Now Matthew 25, you recall that here we have a separated company out here, and very obviously, who are they? Who are they? The Church of God, right? Is this the Church of God down here? Impossible. They are the rejecters of God and His truth, so they can't be the Church of God. Here is the Church of God. Now, first of all, they preach a message of power in the churches, and that message will be Christ and His righteousness. It'll generate persecution, and then and only then will they preach the second angel's message, come out of her, my people. True? You look at Revelation 18 and ask yourself the question, is that not the exact pattern that will happen in the last days? And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. Now it says he has great power. Now you turn back to Revelation 14 and note the similarity of the wording there. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having, and here's that word again, isn't it? Having, what does he have? Good. Now what is the everlasting gospel? It's great power, isn't it? God's power. So what's the difference in these two messages? There's none, is there? So in other words, you could read in Revelation 18 verse 1, and after these things I saw another angel come down from heaven, having the everlasting gospel, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen that great, and has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Very good. Now let's pause there a moment and consider what we've read so far. Now I do not believe that those who preach the loud cry message are going to devote all their time and their energy to picking up the sins in the churches and presenting those as you find the average reformer does at the present time. Not at all. As we've learned before, the best and the surest way to expose sin is to present what? The truth, righteousness. Because sin appears at its worst, where righteousness appears at its best. And the message tells us, of course, that in the last days it'll be the proclamation of Christ and His righteousness. This theme will swallow up all others, Sister White says, in regard to the 1888 message. Now, when that message goes in power, what will it generate? Persecution. It's not mentioned here, but it is mentioned in great controversy in various places there. Very good. So we have the message goes, then comes persecution, then what comes next? Look at verse 4. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. Now can you see that you can take Revelation chapter 18, verse 1 to 4, and lay it right in here with Matthew 25, and they tell the same story. Can you see that? The same story exactly. In both cases, the message goes, persecution follows, and then comes the cry, come out of her, my people. This, of course, is a direct prophecy of the future. Well, so is Matthew 25, because it is also a direct prophecy taken from the book Matthew 25, and the Sister Wise says the parable has been and will be fulfilled to the very letter. Now I want to read now a little statement from early writings where Sister White plainly predicts that in the last days there will be people called out of both the Seventh-day Adventist and the fallen churches. This statement, of course, comes as a great surprise to many people. They don't believe such a statement could ever be written, but here it is in plain terms on page 261 of the book Early Writings. Now note the wording, just what it says, I saw that God has honest children among the nominal Adventists and the fallen churches. And before the plague shall be poured out, ministers and people will be called out from these churches and will gladly receive the truth. And note the wording it says, and now first of all, let me make this point, this statement applies at a time just before the plague should be poured out. So therefore we have to ask ourselves the question, who are the nominal Adventists at that point of time? Now what does the word nominal mean? In name only, doesn't it? Right? In name only. Very good. Now the time just before the plague should be poured out, of course, is during the loud cry, isn't it? After that comes the plagues. So the loud cry period is the time just before the plagues should be poured out, and during that time, ministers and people will be called out of those churches which will then be called the nominal Adventist churches. And that's almost today, isn't it? Now today, what churches in the world are nominal Adventists? Right, the Seventh-day Adventists, and who else? Reformed Adventists. They're Adventists in name only, isn't that true? In nothing else but name. Good. And the fallen churches, who are they? The Protestants. Pardon? That's right, the Sunday-keeping churches, the Protestant churches. So here you have in the plainest of terms, where Sister White says there, that from a nominal church of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and from the Reformed churches, together with the Protestant churches, they will be called out during that period, those who will join with the people of God, and will go forward to face the great final test of the death decree, those who pass to go into the marriage, and those who fail to go back into the world from which they came, never more, ever, to walk with the people of God. What a solemn and, well, what a solemn prophecy this is, warning us of the hour to which we've come and of our great personal need at the present time. The prophecy is clear. It's very, very plain. Mind you, I agree that only those who have received the first angel's message will ever understand it or receive it. The rest can never do that. But let's go back now for a moment to 1844 and ask yourself the question, if you had lived back in 1844, knowing what you know now, where would you have chosen to have stood? Down here with the rejecters who said they were the Church of God, or up here with this despised company? The answer's obvious, isn't it? But here's the real test of where you would have stood if you'd lived back there. You will show by where you will stand today, here or here, where you would have stood if you'd lived back there in 1844. Isn't that true? That's very true. So the choice is ours. Now we can choose, of course, today to stand with the rejectors of the message and we'll lose our eternal life. But we shall stand with the despised remnant out here in separation, and with them receive the training and the schooling, then we shall be in the position to receive the mighty outpouring of the midnight cry and be in the forefront of those who shall carry the loud cry message and gather in the last harvest to fill the wedding with guests, so the king can come in the judgment, the sealing be made, the seven last plagues fall, and Christ come in the clouds of glory. I trust that this message tonight will be so plain and clear to your minds that you'll have no doubt as to where you should stand, what you should be doing, what you should be receiving, so we can take part in that final work and rejoice together in the homemade new. May not one of us be absent of that hour, is my prayer tonight.